Okay, well, welcome everybody. Gentleman's going to put the lights out. Good to see you all here again. It's always a good sign. It's not how many. What's that?
Oh, is it on? Is it on? He says. That's the trouble.
I'm so used to speaking without it on, I have to then speak more quietly. It's not how many people come to the first lecture that counts, it's actually how many people come to the second lecture, you know. And I was glad to see that we've still got a full house. Okay, today we're going to take up the story where we left it off yesterday with this image of our, let's pretend this is our sun 4,500 million years ago, our sun with its disk of dust and gas. Again, mainly hydrogen and helium, but the heavy elements that have been produced by all the stars that came and went before this moment of birth took place. Incidentally, this particular object has been born right now inside the Orion Nebula, which accounts for this luminous blue background. Now, the great thing about astronomy, the great thing about science is that we keep getting new data, and we have to assess that data, and this is really in the last year or so, well, no, last few years, but a series of papers were published last year that has really kind of revolutionized our ideas about how the solar system formed. I mean, it was kind of obvious that if you've got a disk and it's rotating around, and today you've got planets and they all rotate around in the same direction in the same plane, then that must lead to planets. But how did it do it? And the revolutionary new data comes from visits we have made to various asteroids and comets with spacecraft to sample some of the material, particularly from comets. Now, we know that comets are very cold objects. The material of a comet evaporates as it gets close to the sun. And so we thought they have always been very cold, and they're very old and very cold. But the surprise was that we found grains of particles, of tiny fragments of rock, if you like, that showed that these were made of minerals that had been processed at high temperatures. So how was that explained? Well, now we have to resort to the theoretical world, and what I'm going to show you now is a theoretical simulation of what we think is going on inside that disk. Now, this is a computer simulation. It's smooth particle hydrodynamics, and you will see the scale, incidentally, 10 astronomical units. So each of these, so this is a couple of hundred astronomical units. That's the size of our solar system. The sun is one astronomical unit from the sun. So this is the outer solar system. And what this simulation shows is that in this rotating dust and gas cloud, we are forming these very large objects, maybe 10 times the mass of Jupiter, by a process of gravitational contraction and heating, just as a star is heated and when it contracts. And in other words, we are able to raise the temperatures in the centers of these blobs to the order of 2,000 degrees or so, which is sufficient to process, to create some of these hot minerals. Now, you will notice we've ended up with less than we started, that these blocks then tend to move in towards the center and are dissipated. So in the next movie, we are going to show a simulation that takes place closer into the solar system, into the center of the solar system, see 10 astronomical units, and you'll see how most of the blobs, as they work in, they completely dissipate. So these protoplanets are entirely destroyed. But if you watch carefully, you will see that one of the last ones to go in ends up with a little black blob in it. There it is, the little black blob is forming there, and there it goes, works its way in, and it ends up in orbit And what is it? It is, in fact, something that has a mass of about 7 times the mass of the Earth and consists of the heavy material, the sort of dense material that you make a rocky planet out of. And it is at about the distance that we anticipate that Jupiter formed from the center of the solar system. Now, we believe that Jupiter was the first planet to form. Within a few million years, this all runs really quite rapidly. It takes place quite fast. Now, of course, these are theoretical models, but these are an attempt to explain how it is that we get material that has been processed at high temperatures far from the sun in the early solar system. Now, basically, what is going to happen is that this thing is now going to accrete some of the gas out of this disk. The sun itself is still being built at this stage. A lot of this gas material will end up inside the sun. So this is the kind of model that we have. And we anticipate that Jupiter was probably the first planet to form in our solar system. Now, when Jupiter first formed, of course, it was a large, huge body. It's this rocky core accumulating gas. It would have been 5 or 6 times its apparent diameter now. It would have had a temperature of, really quite a high temperature of maybe 1,000 degrees or so. Now, the next stage in the formation of the solar system is also a kind of very new, and I'm going to summarize it from this illustration that came from Nature last year that went along with a much more detailed paper summarizing the formation of the solar system. So these rocky planetismals, these are these kind of small rocky aggregations, the sort of thing we saw on a larger scale forming Jupiter in that previous simulation. And we have these, there's Jupiter, this region here, rocky planetismals, is the region of the inner planets. And out here, we have water-rich planetesimals. This is called the snow line, where Jupiter formed. And inside that region, water would be evaporated. So we have a big... The rocky planetesimals and a lot of gas are in a big disk orbiting the sun. The sun is down this axis here. And then, by dynamical processes that I can't explain in any kind of simple-minded way, Jupiter, believe it or not, moves in towards the inner solar system. And as it does, it compresses and drives these objects, compresses them, drives them into elliptical orbits, scatters some of them out here, beyond its orbit to the outer solar system. And as it compresses and crowds up the planetesimals here, it triggers the formation of the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And as Jupiter moves in, Saturn is still growing at this stage, and then Saturn moves in behind Jupiter. It's all due to gravitational interaction. These are losing energy. They are giving some energy, tending these into elliptical orbits, and transferring some of their angular momentum and potential energy into these objects here by scattering them out. Saturn moves in, then they come into a resonance, and they both move back out again to more or less the position that Jupiter occupies today. And as they move out, they scatter some of this stuff back, and they scatter some of this material into the inner solar system, so that in the last stage, we end up with the rocky planets forming here. All this takes place in about a million years or so, but it takes another 150 million years for these rocky planets to be built up by successive collisions. And we end up with a mixture of water-rich asteroids and rocky asteroids, which is one of the observations that has to be explained and is one of the justifications for this theory. In the meantime, Jupiter moves out and Saturn move out. And then later on, they will cause material that is way out here to be scattered into the inner solar system, throughout the solar system, to cause what we call the late heavy bombardment. So that is the sort of picture we have today of the early history of the solar system. So after 150 million years or so, things had, well, they're reasonably well settled down, and we ended up with the suite of planets that we see today. Now, there were other things that were taking place in that early stage of the fault build-up of the inner planets, the rocky planets. There were many collisions. One of those collisions, with something about the size of Mars with the Earth, we believe created our moon, and we will see that we have rather a large moon in relation to the size of moons of other planets, and that may be crucial for the development of advanced life on Earth. Okay, so here we are today with our four rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars, and then our four gas giants, and poor old Pluto is no longer classed as a planet. I always forget what it's called. I call it a Kuiper Belt asteroid. Its technical name is a dwarf planet. And there's a nice symmetry there, gas giants, rocks. And we think that these objects have rocky cores, but we don't know. This object, Jupiter, is essentially identical in composition to the Sun. If it was 15 times more massive, it would have enough gravitational squeeze, if you like, to raise the central temperature to start burning deuterium or tritium. It would sort of light up as a brown dwarf. So that's like the Sun. These other planets have proportionately more water in their composition. Okay, now 4,500 million years later, the solar system has already beginning to show its age. And we'll now have a look at some of the planets, and the planet that is really beginning to show its age is Mercury. You'll notice that Mercury is heavily scarred, heavily cratered, and that is a sign that it has an old surface, largely left over from that late heavy bombardment that took place within maybe a couple of hundred million years of the start of the solar system. Now, as I say, it's beginning to show its age. Its rate of rotation is slowing down. It does three rotations only for every two orbits of the Sun. It orbits the Sun in about 88 days, and that means that every 176 days the Sun rises and the temperature on the surface rises to 750 degrees, and 176 days later the Sun sets and the temperature drops to about minus 180 degrees. So it's a pretty unsavory place, an unpleasant place to live. Now, we know very little about Mercury because it's too close to the Sun in angular distance to be observed with the Hubble Space Telescope. It was visited by the Voyagers about 20 or more years ago. But we have a spacecraft that arrived there last March, and it's called MESSENGER, and it is beginning to send back images of the surface. And we see some interesting geological effects. There are ridges here that suggest that the surface has shrunk. We also see evidence for volcanic activity. If you look towards the edges, you'll see quite a cratered region. But if you look here, you'll see a smaller craters and a kind of sort of gentle, pasty background. And we believe this is the result of volcanic activity. Now, there are also some very strange features on the surface. We think this is partly a crater, but partly the result of volcanic activity. This is a scale of about 5 kilometers or so. But if we were to look at just a small area of this crater in some detail, there we are, this corner here, we see these very strange, completely unknown, what they are, features. They're cavities in the surface, as though some material has sublimed, has, in other words, changed from a solid into a gas and left a sort of scars on the surface. And we really don't understand what these mechanisms are. I mean, these images are coming back. I mean, I downloaded this image for this lecture a few weeks ago. So, you know, so they see them, they know they're dips, but we don't yet know what the mechanism, what material it is that is being evaporated, whether it's some volatile substance. And the other thing that we see that we really don't see elsewhere in the are these sort of rifts. that we see all over the surface here, as though the surface has shrunk and cracked, but some kind of tectonic activity has been taking place. So Mercury is coming up with lots of surprises, and we'll sort of watch this space to hear what's going to happen. Now, Mercury does have one particular surprise that we've known about for some years now, and this is actually a radar observation made from Earth with the Arecibo telescope. So it's not an optical image taken from a spacecraft like the other ones I've been showing you. And what it shows from the polarization of the reflected radar signal is the evidence for water, or ice to be more exact, in the inside these craters. So despite these enormous temperature changes, these craters are very close to the North Pole, and the sun never shines into them. And so it has been possible for ice to remain there. So there is water on Mercury, which is really quite amazing. And we think that that water has been taken there by a comet impact. So that came as a great surprise, and that's a radar observation. And I'm looking forward to the optical images of this particular region. But of course they'll be dark because the sun doesn't shine into those craters. Now, when we come to the next planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, it's a bit like one of those compare and contrast exercises we have at school. They all have atmospheres. We'll look at the atmosphere in a moment. The Earth is the most massive of these. Venus has about 0.8 the mass of the Earth, and Mars is a tenth the mass of the Moon. It's about a hundredth the mass of the Earth. And so we can compare them. And one of the interesting things, I said, well, all these three have atmospheres. The Moon doesn't have an atmosphere. And what I'm showing here is the relative compositions of the atmosphere. So the area of the circle is proportional to the amount of that particular gas. So you see Venus and Mars both have atmospheres rich in carbon dioxide, whereas the Earth has very little carbon dioxide. The Earth's carbon dioxide is largely, it has the same amount of carbon dioxide per unit mass, but on Earth it's mostly locked up in rocks of one form or another, or dissolved in the sea. Now, so we have the potential for a very strong greenhouse effect. But note at the top, 89 bar. So very broadly speaking, Venus's atmosphere is 100 times the pressure of Earth's atmosphere, 1 bar, and 0.006, where you could say Mars is 100 the atmospheric pressure of the Earth. So Venus, with so much carbon dioxide in its atmosphere, has a very strong greenhouse effect that raises the temperature by 470 degrees or so to about 477 centigrade. The Earth only is raised by about 30 degrees, and Mars, because it has so little CO2, the temperature is only raised by about 6 degrees, and the average temperature is well below freezing. Incidentally, one of the things we do is that we pick up the meteorites that have been struck off the surface of Mars and eventually end up landing on the Earth. And the way that we can tell that those meteorites come from Mars is by looking at the proportion of these gases. So we've got nitrogen and argon and CO2 in the meteorite, and we can show that it's identical to that of Mars, which is an interesting way of doing it. Okay, let's have a look at Venus. Venus is completely shrouded in cloud, and incidentally, you can see Venus in the sky if you go out after sunset. It is the brightest star you'll see kind of towards the sun in the sky. You'll see Venus nearer the sun and then Jupiter higher up in the sky. Venus, despite being the goddess of love, is a very unsavory place. Very high. Maybe some people say that's the consequence of love too, but you never know. Thick clouds, carbon dioxide, it rains sulfuric acid. Does that sound like your marriage? No. Certainly not like mine. And despite that, the Russians managed to land a satellite on the surface of Mars. And this satellite, a Venera probe, landed in 1981, and it lasted for 2 hours before it was overcome by the high temperatures. I mean, 470 centigrade is well above the temperature you cook stuff. It's above the melting point of lead and tin. In fact, conditions on the surface of Mars are not too different from those inside a gas-cooled nuclear reactor. The pressure is twice as high as in a gas-cooled nuclear reactor, and the temperature is a little bit cooler. In fact, Venus, did I say Mars? Golly, yes, shame. Yeah, Venus. Thank you for that correction. This is Venus, the goddess of love. Yes, how could I forget? Yeah. So all that, this is Venus. Or read all those facts as referring to Venus. And, so what was rather exciting, that these images, you may remember some of the first images that came, that were sort of little strips and barely decipherable, but the data, the original stream of data, has been completely reworked by an American Don Mitchell. And he has been able to show these distant ridges, and I think this is that you see along the horizon there, you can see one, two, even a hint of a third distant ridge. And I think that is very evocative, that here we are looking in detail at the surface of another planet. This, incidentally, is the cover off one of the cameras. And what we're looking at, we think, is some sort of basalt-like rock surface. The surface of Venus is, in fact, very young. And because of the high temperatures, things look very different on the surface of Venus. We see very, very few craters, which is an indication that the surface is young. This is what a volcanic eruption could look like on the surface of Venus. These are 60 kilometers in diameter, and you can see it's sort of spreading out like a pancake. We believe that every few thousand million years, it's possible that the whole surface of Venus is overturned in some kind of huge volcanic outpouring. There are no active volcanoes currently active on the surface of Venus. So there isn't the tectonic activity that we have on the surface of the Earth. Okay, as we move out, we come to Earth, of course, and Earth has tectonic activity. The continents move around, they collide, build mountains, we have water, and we have an atmosphere, and it's a perfect environment for life. And we'll think a bit more about the Earth when we consider whether we are alone. Now, I just want to make some comments about a spacecraft that is currently orbiting the Moon. But this image, of course, comes from a much earlier time. This is the Apollo 12 landing back in November 1969. And why am I showing it? Well, you notice this satellite had arrived a couple of years earlier, a Surveyor satellite that landed, and here's an astronaut who's come out of the landing module up there and come over to investigate this. And with the new Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, we are able to see this landing ground. And so there is the satellite that he's looking at. There is his lunar lander, and you can see a trail of footprints. And I think this is rather fun. There's the landing module, and there's the satellite. And the field of view that we were looking at in the last picture, he's standing here, is more or less like that. And so we have been able to image all the landing sites, and you can see a little white blob up there, and other trails of footprints going off in different directions, and I thought this is rather nice. I mean, it won't convince anybody that the whole thing wasn't a big setup in Arizona, because obviously this is all just a big simulation as well. But there you are. If you believe it's the Moon, then there you are, there's the Moon, and that's what we are looking at. Now, it isn't just going up there to look at the lunar landing sites. And just by way of example of some of the quality of the data, I thought I'd show you these images of Tycho, which is a relatively fresh impact on the surface of the Moon. You can see the trails of debris going off. So here is Tycho with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and typical of these large craters. It has a central peak, which is the sort of thing, this is 80 kilometers or so in diameter. This is the effect of rebound of the rocks during the impact. And what we're going to do is just look a little bit more closely at that central peak, and you see the details of material sliding down with a resolution of about a meter, and you'll see a big block in the middle there, the shadow, of course, and the hard shadows in the moon with no atmosphere. And here we are zooming in to that central block that is about 75 meters high. So this is the kind of detail that the moon is now being with which the moon is now being examined, and you know, 100 meter scale. So very exciting, looking at geological features that we have not really been aware of before. We see, they look like rivers, but they're not rivers at all. They're places where material has been flowing, or maybe even lava has moved at one stage. The surface of the moon, of course, is very, very ancient. It is heavily cratered because it shows the results of that late heavy bombardment. The Earth would have been far more cratered, but of course all those craters have been obliterated by natural geological processes. Okay, when we move on finally to Mars, and let's hope I go on calling it Mars, perhaps our first impression of Mars might be slightly disappointing, because we see that there are a lot of evidence for craters. But of course we have known about the existence of water, of ice caps on Mars, for well over 100 years. A newspaper man once said to me, a science correspondent, he said, and I found this a bit, that, you know, we're always making rediscoveries. And he said, the most frequent rediscovery, and i.e. major press release, will be the discovery of water on Mars. And we're going to have a couple of those discoveries even in this lecture. So, you know, 100 years ago, evidence for water on Mars. Now, when we look at the height of the Martian surface, here's the calibration from minus 8 kilometres to plus 12 kilometres, we then do start to see some very interesting features. Not only do we see this series of volcanoes here, we see these great chasms running down, and we see lower regions here, and we think... more and more we are thinking this, that there may well have been a time early in the history of the solar system when Mars had quite extensive seas, lakes, seas, whatever you like, on its surface. Now, why? So, and there is evidence for water today, but where did all the seas go? Well, the secret may be when shown here, that when we look for a magnetic field on Mars, there are patches of weak field, but essentially Mars has no magnetic field any longer, little bits left. And what does the magnetic field, well, how do we get a magnetic field? Well, we have quite a strong magnetic field on Earth, and that magnetic field is generated by the movement, the turbulent, the slow movement of hot electrically conducting magma inside the Earth that generates and maintains the magnetic field. So the result is that the Earth, and we'll talk a bit more about this tomorrow, has this very strong magnetosphere, and it's the magnetosphere that last night largely protected us from the coronal mass ejection from the Sun, but nevertheless some of that material leaked down through to the poles here, and I gather there were some spectacular aurorae that were seen yesterday. Now, as you know, the Earth's upper atmosphere has what is called an ionosphere, where the UV radiation ionizes the gases in the Earth's atmosphere, but those gases, the upper part of the Earth's atmosphere, is protected by the magnetosphere from the ionizing gas that is blowing past in the solar wind. The Mars, on the other hand, does not have that protection, although it has a very weak magnetosphere, and we believe that it is possible that the surface, that the water evaporated, the gases were ionized, and then stripped off blown away by the Earth's, by the sun's particles streaming past by the solar wind. So that this may be the reason that Mars only had an atmosphere significant atmosphere and significant seas of water, perhaps for the first 1,000 million years of its history. But nevertheless, it might have had enough time to develop life, and of course that is the exciting thing we're looking for. But nevertheless, when we look at Mars, and here we see a couple of volcanoes on the surface, this one is about 130 kilometers across, and there you see a bit of cloud here. You see, wherever you look, evidence for erosion, for what looks like water erosion, very much so. Wherever we look on the surface, and in particular in this region here, where we see a crater that's being filled in, we see this kind of striation here, and we see this blocky sort of breakup of the surface material. I think that some of this may be a little bit like permafrost, that there is a lot of ice and frozen in here, and this is the way this material is breaking up. But wherever we look, as I say, we see this evidence for water. And then, again, this image, I always think, for anybody who has travelled, perhaps even travelling through the Karoo, this kind of escarpment will look really quite familiar to you. But when you look closely at this, you can see that there is evidence that water has flowed here, and there's also evidence for other periods when water has flowed. And it's possible that water is mobilized every so often, every few tens of millions of years. The water that still is there is mobilized, and this could be due to the parameters of Mars's orbit. The changing angle of inclination means that we get proportionately more heating at the poles, driving the moisture that is at the poles down to equatorial zones. But one of the most exciting things that has recently come out is this series of images, and I hope it's going, yes, it is showing this. These are, it's not really a movie, it's a series of images. If you look up at the top, you will see that they're taken from sort of winter through spring to summer. And this is high ground here, and we see evidence for what looks like something flowing down into the plain and evaporating. Now the catch is that we know that water is not, with these low temperatures and low atmospheric pressures, water is not stable on the surface of Mars. If you put some ice out there, it would turn straight into gas, it would sublime. And so it's hypothesized that what we're seeing here is evidence for salty water that is flowing maybe just beneath the surface. But again, this is all a bit of a mystery, and I'm just going to show you, I think this one, maybe is this going to show a similar effect? No, it is. Yes, it is. There we go. You can see a similar effect. And again, you can, for those of you who, I always think when I look at these things, I think of the Karoo. I mean, it's probably, you know, not a good analogy, but it does give you a sense of the sort of place it is. So this is very, very exciting. It only came out last August, and so we still want to know exactly what's going on there. Now, we do see stuff happening on Mars, and in this case, we're seeing the edge of the polar cap. We are seeing a landslide of some sort that is whirling, spreading out across the plain. And just to give you a sense of scale, these cliffs are about 700 meters high, so this thing shown in the third dimension, there's the picture at the top. We've got some very, very steep cliffs here with the sort of the polar ice cap up there, a material cascading down and spreading out on the plain below. It's about, you can see, 500 metres across, but the cliffs are 700 metres high. And some of the flow that we see may be caused, this may be largely driven by not water but carbon dioxide. It's very difficult to be exactly certain what's going on. To me, at my age, this is one of the most, in a way, awe-inspiring images, because it looks so familiar. Tracks across the desert. If you saw this in the Namib Desert, you'd be pretty fed up, because some idiot would have gone out with his four-wheel drive and driven across the landscape that he was certainly not allowed to drive across. And you know that those tracks would be there for maybe 100 years or so. Well, this is no idiot. This is, of course, one of the rovers. In fact, it's Opportunity, which landed back in January 2004. Shown on the diagram, a little bit bigger than life size because the wheels are 10 inches in diameter, which is about 10 inches. And these are extraordinary triumphs of American technology because they were only supposed to last for 3 months, and they've lasted for 8 years. At least this one is still, well, Opportunity is still going, Spirit has broken up. This, in fact, is a simulated image, of course, taken back in the laboratory. Now, part of the secret of the success of these things has been that we get dust devils that blow across the surface of Mars and blow the dust off the solar panels and keep them working. So there it is. It was exploring, and it came to a stop here and looked around, you know, did some tests on the rocks, and you will see there's a small impact site here. So where was it? Well, it was on the edge of a big crater, as you can see. Notice how the sky is quite, it's not dark, it's light, because of course there's a lot of dust in the atmosphere. And in fact, it was exploring this crater called the Victoria Crater, which is about a kilometre in diameter. And it was somewhere up top right there. But let's see exactly where, because with one of the other satellites that is orbiting Mars, it is possible you can see the trail of the little vehicle, its tracks there, and you see the white spots wherever it stopped to make some kind of measurement. And in fact, the place where it stopped to take the photograph of its own tracks, and you can see the blobs a bit ahead of it, is right there where the arrow is. So there it is, exploring that area, and what I want to show you now is a view that it took when it was standing at the convergence of those two arrows and looking across the landscape at Cape St. Vincent. The Americans love to give everything names. So what we're going to see is Cape St. Vincent, and I don't know whether this is a commemoration of Nelson. I don't know whether they know about Nelson, but they are. Anyway, there's Cape St. Vincent. And again, to me, this is quite extraordinary. Here we are looking at the surface of another planet with the kind of intimacy and detail with which we're used to examining the surface of our own planet. When I was a child, the idea of even sending a rocket to the moon was the stuff of Dan Dare and comics and things. And here we are looking at this. And what are we looking at? Well, we can see debris at the top here, which is the result of stuff that's been kicked out of this crater when the impact took place. But we see some quite clear bedding here, strata here, and we see some effect of cross-bedding. And this cross-bedding, I have to go to Liverpool sometimes. I can't help thinking as I go in to the last bit into Liverpool Station, you go through this wonderful Triassic sandstone laid down in a very dry period of the Earth's history. There you are, the railway lines and the cross-bedding there that we see going into Liverpool Lime Street, and the cross-bedding we see on the surface of Mars. And maybe the origin of those rocks is very similar, laid down under dry desert conditions. So this is the sort of way that we can look at our nearby neighbouring planet. Now, since it has explored Victoria Crater, it is head off towards another much larger crater. And of course, the trip is quite hazardous because you go over these very soft sandy regions, and indeed, Spirit, poor old Spirit, got bogged down in the sand and has stalled and is really now out of action. And then there are the denser regions. So this thing is controlled from Earth, and it treks across and heads slowly and ponderously towards this. It's now arrived at Spirit Point on the edge of this crater. There's Victoria Crater up there that it was exploring, and now it's coming to the edge of this crater, and it has peered into this crater, and this is the view it sees. And again, a very, to me, a very familiar sort of scene. Now, what is exciting about this crater, and possibly some of these rocks here, is that this crater has gone much deeper. It's a much bigger thing, and it has possibly thrown out rocks from a much earlier period in the history of Mars that may well be a time when there might have been life on Mars, which, of course, is the kind of motivation we have behind all this sort of exploration. And it's, of course, started to explore around here, and one of the things that it's noted is, and again, this looks extraordinarily Karoo-like to me, it's noted this little kind of line of rock here, and of course, it can't do a sort of geological analysis like a geologist would, but it does have the means of detecting what elements are present there. And it's certainly found calcium and sulfur, so that these may be some calcium sulfate. There it is, if you haven't seen it. And here is that little ridge seen in more detail. This may be what we would call gypsum, possibly, if we found it on Earth. And again, this would be evidence that this material was laid down in wet conditions. So there it is, making this exploration. And of course, you can see the way, it's both frustrating and very exciting, because you can see how lovely it would be if we could have people on the surface of Mars doing this exploration, geologists. But on the other hand, you can see it becomes increasingly more difficult to justify the huge danger and expense of sending people there when we can do so much with this sort of careful analysis. Now, there are some other rather strange and rather awe-inspiring looking things on the surface of Mars, and these are two sinkholes, and you can see that as the wind blows over, it has clearly excavated stuff that it has blown across the surface, and by overexposing, and these are brought together, we can peer into these sinkholes that are about 100 meters across. The walls appear to be vertical, and you can see a bit of sort of blown sand on the bottom there. We also see sinkholes on the surface of the moon. Not clear what these are, but one possibility is that they correspond to lava tubes, where lava flowed underground. You see this sort of thing in Hawaii. And then when the lava cools, you have a long hollow tunnel, and then it's possible for the roof to collapse. But again, we don't know what those are. Now this, I think, is supposed to show you the changes, maybe it's not going to, in the surface of a, yes, there we are. This is a sand dune that has been observed 3 years apart, and we can see how the dune has, it's a bit staccato because it's only two images, and maybe it's not as impressive as I thought it was, but you can see how the sand dune is creeping across the surface here and revealing the surface, just like sand dunes do in Namibia. And something else that is familiar to us, and this is with one of the cameras on the lunar rover, we see these wonderful dust devils blowing across the surface of the landscape. And of course they help when they blow across one of the ranges, they help clear the solar panels, and when they blow across the landscape they leave these strange, almost organic looking trails. You can see boulders here and a crater. Now we are used to watching the sunset on Earth. This is a sunset in dusty Namibia, but we can now also watch the sunset on Mars. And here it is, setting over some hills 80 kilometres away. The Sun, incidentally, is two-thirds its size than it would appear on Earth, because, of course, Mars is further away from the Earth, and there is the sunset sky darkening. Okay, let's leave Mars and move out. Between Mars and Jupiter, we have a huge collection of asteroids, a place where a planet never formed, possibly never could form because of the disturbance of Jupiter. This is the way we see it, with some 370,000 asteroids. None of them amounting, the whole mass probably amounts to less than the mass of the moon, but nevertheless, and this is seen edge on in the plane, these things are comets, these arrows, very important to us because some of those asteroids cross the Earth's orbit, and if they cross the Earth's orbit, they have the potential to do us a lot of damage if they were to collide with the Earth. Although we believe that none are due to collide within the next 70 years, nothing bigger than about a kilometre in size. This is Eros, 33 kilometres or so across, and here is Vesta. We find that these things are probably really quite, they're not that heavily compacted. They are quite loose, quite rubble-like. This is about 500 kilometres in diameter. And we have a spacecraft that has been looking at it in some detail, looking close to the surface. Another example is Ida here. This thing is, again, about 30 kilometres in diameter. They're all irregular shaped. You have to be bigger than 600 kilometres in diameter before gravity is sufficient to overcome the natural strength of the rock and pull you into a sphere. One of the weirdest asteroids is this Itokawa, visited by the Japanese spacecraft Hayabusa, which is only about 500 metres long, and it really is a loose pile of rubble. And what we think has happened here is that this is the result of a collision, and interestingly, early last year, this object was seen and observed by the Hubble Space Telescope. It looks superficially like a comet, but is not a comet because this is in fact purely a dust tail. There is no ionized gas in this. And we think that this may be the result of a low velocity collision that took place in the asteroid belt early last year. But as I said, Itokawa was visited by the spacecraft Hayabusa, and here is the shadow of Hayabusa, and Hayabusa managed to touch down on the surface. It actually had a bit of a collision and damaged itself, managed to bring back some material from the surface of this asteroid back to Earth, and this is one of the sources of material that tells us about the early solar system. This thing in the ring here, this is a navigation beacon that contains something like 500,000 signatures, apart from anything else. A lot of people wanted to have their names commemorated and left on the surface of Hayabusa. Now, I said, it is a very, very strange object, and you will see large boulders that are casting shadows here, dotted around on the surface. There is no way these boulders could have been formed in situ. So what we think happened was there was a fairly low velocity collision between two asteroids. Two large lumps were left over in slow orbit around each other, and they slowly aggregated all this other debris till they not only covered themselves but coated the material between them. Okay, let's move rapidly on and get as far as Jupiter, and that's very much the way Jupiter would look through a pair of binoculars or small telescope. But the interesting thing about Jupiter, we're not going to really focus much on Jupiter, we're going to have a quick look at the moons of Jupiter, sometimes referred to as the Galilean moons. There they are, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and showing because Galileo was the first to see them and saw that they formed a model of a solar system. And they range in properties from Io, which is the only object, almost the only object in the solar system that is currently volcanically active. There it is. You can see a plume of material spewing up from the surface of Io, and it's backlit by Jupiter. Europa here is in the foreground, so not backlit. When we look at Io, it might remind you of your days in the chemistry lab where you found the various allotropic forms of sulfur, yellow, red, and the sort of dark colour, because we not only have volcanoes of rock, but we have volcanoes of sulfur on the surface of Io. Why is Io volcanic? It's because the core is very hot. Why is the core very hot? It's because it experiences the differential tidal pull of Jupiter, which is heating up its core and keeping it hot and volcanically active. If we move on to Europa, it doesn't look terribly exciting at this kind of resolution, but when we zoom in on it, we see something that looks very familiar to us. Despite the enormous size, this is 65 kilometers across. These appear to be great ice flows that have broken and refrozen into a sea of ice. We see an analogous thing on the surface of the Earth on a much smaller scale. This is only about a mile across. Ice flows freezing back into the sea. And where we see frozen ice flows, we believe there is a liquid sea. I've just got to take this thing off now. Liquid sea beneath. Oopsie. Excuse me for this slight pause here. I give this gentleman. There we are.
Thank you very much. That's
good. Oops. Oh, hang on. We're still tangled. Okay. Where we see ice flows, then we believe beneath the ice there is a sea. A sea kept liquid again by the gravitational forces of Jupiter, which is very interesting because this is deriving its heat not from the sun, but from Jupiter. And where there is a sea, there is the possibility of life. I hasten to add that the dark material here is not organic. They are apparently hydrated salts of magnesium, magnesium sulfates, and so on, from the light. But when we get as far as Callisto, then we see a body far enough from Jupiter, it is not feeling the differential tidal effects, that is just essentially an undifferentiated mass of ice and dust and rock left over from the formation of the solar system. And when we look at the surface, we see it covered in a dark layer of dust that has been left behind as the ice sublimes very, very slowly from these white little peaks here, the places where the ice is coming through the surface. Let us now move on to Saturn, and we are getting the most extraordinarily beautiful images of Saturn with the Cassini spacecraft that is currently exploring Saturn. And it's been exploring for some years, and Saturn has moved through into spring and summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And last, in December 2010, we saw this enormous storm, great thunderstorm, developing in the Northern Hemisphere of Saturn. And by February, the effect of the storm had almost entirely wrapped around the planet. This was very early for these storms to be created because this, of course, is a gaseous body. There is no solid surface here. It's gas all, well, and probably is something solid. It may be gas all the way down to solid hydrogen somewhere in the core. One of the most beautiful and awe-inspiring images of Saturn, to my mind, is this one. And what it shows is from the Cassini spacecraft, an eclipse of the Sun by Saturn. Of course, Saturn's angular size is vastly bigger than the Sun, but the Sun is in the line here, so sunlight is scattering off the rings and beginning to shine through the atmosphere here. And if you look very, very carefully at this picture, you'll see a little dot up there, and that little dot is us. And that was us on, I think, the 26th of September, was it 2005 or something? There we are, and there's the dot with a bit of a blob sticking up top left there, which is the Earth and our moon. So that is not just a portrait of Saturn, that is a portrait of ourselves. And I think that is, to me, that is a very awe-inspiring and very rather beautiful image. Okay, let's move on. There are some rather beautiful effects. I should say something about Saturn's rings. The diameter of Saturn's rings is something like the distance of the Earth to the Moon. The thickness of the rings is perhaps only tens of meters. Now, at a certain time during Saturn's orbit around the Sun, the plane of the rings points exactly towards the Sun. And so you will see this little satellite here is casting a shadow, that line, right across the rings. But you also see another rather beautiful effect that is just simply the effect of gravity. As this little moon orbits, and it goes around, when things orbit, the closer you are to the planet, the faster you go. So that lot's going fast, this thing's going more slowly, and this is going even more slowly, and this outer edge more slowly. As this thing orbits around, it moves on an eccentric orbit, and it pulls out a tail of dust from the rings. But now, and you see the tail up there is pointing down towards the ring. So what happens is, a tail is initially pulled out, but this bit then moves on faster than this bit. So the tail, that might have pulled out that way, gets more and more elongated. So you see from the previous orbit, the tail up there pulled out, and the tail out here being pulled out. And this is just the effect of gravity on the rings of Saturn. One of the things we discovered an infrared telescope that was launched a few years ago was that Saturn, with its familiar rings all inside here, has a vast, much larger ring that sits more or less in the plane of the solar system. And here is a bit of an infrared observation of it. And that much larger ring explains two strange observations. The first was the existence of this moon Phoebe, which is not, like the other moons of Saturn, inclined to the plane, the same plane as the rings, and this poor old Iapetus that is covered, that has this black smudge on its face. We have known, here is Phoebe, this thing is about 200 kilometers in diameter, and we've known for some years that Phoebe looks more like a comet than a moon. It looks like a dead comet. And that is undoubtedly what it is, and that huge ring is the debris from the comet, and some of that debris is plastered onto the front of Iapetus as it orbits round and goes through that debris, and there we see these patches of black debris. Now, one of the most unusual and intriguing images is, of course, of the moon Titan. And this is a series of images taken with the Hubble Space Telescope turned into a movie. So there goes Titan. And there's its shadow, comes on first, and you'll see another moon whip out around the other side of Saturn. There it comes out around the back there. Now, that's Tethys. So Titan, we have known for a long time, is featureless because it has a thick atmosphere. And that is very exciting because that thick atmosphere is dominated by nitrogen. So it may well have been the sort of conditions that existed when the Earth was very young. And you may well remember the Cassini-Huygens released a probe called Huygens that floated down through the atmosphere of Titan. And as it did, it took pictures and it showed us something that we have seen nowhere else in the solar system except on Earth. Things that look like a clear riverine structure. We see this pattern of rivers. And when it finally landed on the surface, it seemed to land in what looked like estuarine mud flats with these circular pebbles. Here's one about 15 centimeters across. Now, when it landed, there was a puff of methane from the warmth of the satellite as it landed on the surface. These are not estuarine floodplains that we would recognize them, but they are totally different. The temperatures here are minus 180 degrees centigrade. These pebbles are undoubtedly, almost certainly, pebbles of ice. They're rocks as far as everything's concerned. The mud flats here, the mud is a mud of methane and ethane. And one of, again, a very unusual and rather intriguing observation, we find it almost impossible to image through the atmosphere, except by using very narrowband special filters. But here is an image of the polar regions of Titan, and they show when those are studied in with radar. Now, radar, you send a beam back, and if it hits a rough surface, some signal comes straight back to you. If it hits a flat surface, the signal is reflected away, and so it appears dark. And this certainly looked like what we believe it is, a sort of estuary. For this is liquid, and liquid flows on the surface of Titan, and liquid flows into these lakes and seas. But this is not water. We think it is what we would call low-pressure gas, methane and ethane. And it rains, it snows ethane, and rains methane, and it causes these things. And if you don't believe, here is a rather lovely example of glint where sunlight is reflected off this smooth, well, relatively smooth lake-like surface. And it would be very exciting to go there. I mean, again, the possibilities of some quite different life form, perhaps living off methane and ethane, but perhaps a landscape that would look familiar to us in some ways, although being totally, totally, utterly alien to us. Okay, I'm going to wind this up very quickly now by just saying something about Enceladus. Look, here is the edge of Saturn, the rings of Saturn. There is Enceladus, two other little moons in the picture there, but let us get straight to Enceladus. Enceladus is only 600 kilometres in diameter compared with the UK, and so it came as a great surprise when we looked at the surface of Enceladus, that looked really quite old up there, to see these light blue stripes that appeared to be of fresh ice, and to realise that jets of material, of water, water ice, were being squirted out of these rifts in the surface of Enceladus. So here we see evidence for water in places where temperatures are minus 200 degrees or so. And here is the origin of one of these things. We'll look in a bit more detail. These have been described as the sort of rifts that you might see at some mid-Atlantic trough or somewhere where the land is rifting up. And gas of water, water vapor. It's difficult to describe it as water. It is water vapor, but it would immediately turn into ice particles. It's kind of spraying up into the air. And again, we think that this may be the result of the heating, tidal heating by Saturn this time, tidally heating the interior of this tiny moon. But here again, water available, liquid water available somewhere far out in the solar system. Right, well, it is quarter past. I think we might have 5 minutes of injury time. You haven't heard about Uranus, Neptune and Pluto, and frankly, there's almost nothing new to say about them. So I don't really apologise for not talking about those. If anybody really wants to know about them, they can ask me. But we don't have any new. What's new in the solar system? Nothing new out there. Okay, thank you very much. We've probably got a few minutes for questions, if anybody would like to ask any questions about this or anything else, incidentally. You may be more interested. Yes. Where is the little vehicle that was on the surface of Mars? Oh, where is it now? It's somewhere on the edge of the Endeavour crater. It started to explore some of the rocks there. And it's controlled from, you know, base in America. So it goes around lots of individual rocks, yes. Sorry, is there anybody on the International Space Station at the moment? To be honest, I have no idea. I don't really follow the International Space Station. I think there probably are. The Russians have a means of taking people up. But to be honest, I'm not sure.
Six.
Six? Yeah. Okay, there you are. Yes.
Is it true that ice enters the atmosphere from somewhere up there?
I know there was a lot of controversy about this some years ago. Is it true that ice enters the Earth's atmosphere? There were these holes that were seen in some ultraviolet imaging that implied that lumps of ice had gone through them. And I can't honestly remember how that was resolved. But there is no doubt there is a lot of meteorite material that enters the Earth's atmosphere. Some of the pieces quite large, and some of that will be, some of them will be stony, and some of them will be icy. So I think that the simple answer to your question is yes, but whether that it's as extensive as we originally thought, I don't know. And there's no doubt that some of our sea, or maybe quite a lot of it, was brought in by comets, but that would have been very early in the history of the solar system. Yeah. Any other? Yes.
I hope this isn't a silly question, but if there is no atmosphere on Mars, where does the wind come from?
No, there is an atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure on Mars is about 1/100th that of Earth. So, and it's carbon dioxide. So it's not an atmosphere that we could live in. We would have to have spacesuits. And it's very low pressure and it hasn't got the right gases. But oh yes, there's plenty of wind blowing across the surface of Mars. It's windy, those dust devils and the building of the sand dunes all rely on that. Well, no, perhaps I was a bit confusing there. What we have lost is a lot of the ocean, a lot of the water on Mars has gone. We think that there might have been seas, and at the time there were seas, there would have been a much denser atmosphere. Not necessarily oxygen, but denser. And we have lost most of that. Yes, so there is a very low pressure atmosphere. Yeah, yeah, yes. Yes.
How easy would it be to seal them off?
To seal them off? Well, we have evidence of that sinkhole. The answer is we don't really know what lava tubes there might be there. We speculate that they are, and I'm sure what you're thinking of is we could probably make a space station inside one of them. And I'm sure the answer to that would be yes, but we don't know enough about them or to what extent they exist. We anticipate they do because there has been volcanic activity, lots of lava flow on Mars, which on the moon, which you can see. But yeah, so hopefully we'll have men back there, but men and women to go and see what's going on. Yeah. Any other questions? That's probably done. Yeah. Thanks very much.
I can only try to
serve.